start. Black. It goes black, but as long as the light is still flashing, then it should work. Alright? But it's just recording.
Should turn this on, you think, or just leave it? It's a small room. Oh, really? Yeah, okay. Testing, okay. We'll just leave it on right now.
So as long as that... You're supposed to get it done. Just press the end and it'll stop.
That's what?
Yeah, I mean, they're different things, but that means microphone and okay. Voice recording. And I just press now. The shutter to stop it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right?
Momentarily.
Two minute warning.
Hi everybody, thank you for coming. My name is Jeremy Stamberger. I hope you're enjoying the conference so far. It is my privilege to introduce Rabbi Dr. Edward Reichman, an Associate Professor of Emergency Medicine at Montefiore Medical Center. Rabbi Reichman is also an Associate Professor of Philosophy and History of Medicine at Albert Einstein College of Medicine, where he teaches Jewish medical ethics. And Rabbi Reichman received his rabbinic ordination from the Rabbi Isaac Elchanan Theological Seminary, and he writes and lectures widely in the field of Jewish medical ethics. Today he will be speaking about non-vital organ transplants in halacha. Rabbi Dr. Reichman, thank you very much.
Jeremy, thank you very much. I hope you've been enjoying a wonderful afternoon here at Yeshiva University with much more excitement to come. The fireworks usually come towards the end of the program, so you'll be anticipating some excitement as things progress as well. The morning session was comprised of live organ donation, and we began a discussion this afternoon on cadaveric organ donation, and the major halachic issue has been primarily the issue of the definition of death. You heard from one of our Rosh Yeshiva, Rav Schechter. You will hear this afternoon from Rabbi Tendler, whom you will see will have a slightly different approach to the issue of the definition of death than Rav Schechter. And you will also hear from Dr. Avram Steinberg. I'm going to, this afternoon, present to you an extension of this conference. And that is the topic of non-vital organ transplants. So all the organs that we've been discussing this morning for transplantation, livers, lungs, kidneys, hearts, which all relate to both living and cadaveric donation, are organs which people require in order to live. They are vital organs. But there is a new and very exciting frontier in the field of transplantation medicine, and that's the field of non-vital organ transplants. And some of these transplants have been receiving a great deal of media and press coverage over the past year or two. The most famous one, perhaps, is the face transplant, which occurred in France. And you have actually on the cover of your handout the post-transplant picture of the first face transplant recipient. There was a follow-up case of a face transplant, successful face transplant in China, also within the last year, of somebody who was mauled by a bear in China. And what I'd like to do this afternoon is to discuss with you, first of all, the different types of non-vital organ transplants and what the potential halachic ramifications are for this very new and exciting frontier. Also, if there's time, if there are any questions that you have from the sessions this morning that require clarification, I'd be delighted to answer any of those questions for you as well. So let us turn the page to our first page two of our handout, where we will discuss four types of non-vital organ transplants. Case number one is face transplant. And here I read for you from one of the press releases about this case. Surgeons in France have carried out the very first face transplant, it has been reported. The woman had lost her nose, lips, and chin after being savaged by a dog. In the controversial operation, tissues, muscles, arteries, and veins were taken from a brain-dead donor, and this, you'll see, will be important for our halachic discussion, and attached to the patient's lower face. And you can see on the right hand over here the same picture. You can see the line on her left cheek. That's the line of the surgical operation. She's healing fairly well. So her nose and mouth are from a donor, someone who died. Doctors stress the woman will not look like her donor, but nor will she look like she did before the attack. Instead, she will have a hybrid face, as you see. The ethical concerns of a face transplant and the psychological impact of the patient of looking different has held teams back. Concerns relating to immunosuppression, which is the requirement to take medicines to sustain a transplant, and just for a brief moment, because this is a very relevant issue for our discussion about non-vital organ transplants, all our discussion, both before and after this session, of organ donation assumes that the recipient needs to take what's called immunosuppressive medicines to sustain a transplant. The way a transplant works, it's taking something which the body considers a foreign organ and transplanting it into a body. Now, if you get a virus, you get a bacteria, your body knows that it's not part of itself, and it immediately attacks it. And the same is true of any organ you receive. If you receive a heart, you receive a liver, your body says, this is not my heart, this is not my liver, and immediately begins to attack it. So one of the major advances and the hurdles which is overcome to allow transplants is to give your body a medicine which will suppress your attacking of the organ and prevent you from rejecting the organ. The problem with immunosuppression is that it not only suppresses your ability to respond to attack that organ, which is a good thing, but also suppresses your ability to attack almost any infection that your body meets. So it's potentially a very dangerous thing. Now, Dr. Greenstein, whom you met this afternoon as well, is a transplant surgeon in Montefiore. We work in the same institution. I very often see his patients in the emergency department where I practice who are transplant recipients who come in because they have a fever. Now, if you or I had a fever, we'd take some Tylenol, we'd sleep it off, maybe wait a day or two. But if you're a transplant recipient, then even a minor fever could be something that's potentially fatal. So they have to present to the physician almost every time they have something even minor because they're on these medicines suppressing their immune system. So the psychological impact is also an issue. Skipping to the last paragraph, a French magazine, Le Point, reports that tissues, muscles, arteries, and veins needed for the transplant were taken from a multi-organ donor in the northern city of Lille, and the donor was brain dead. In a statement, the hospital said the woman had been gravely disfigured in the attack in May this year. She had been unable to speak or eat properly since. This is also a very important factor in our discussions of the halakhic ramifications of this face transplant. Like any other transplant, the woman will have to take immunosuppressant drugs to help her cope with the donated tissue, and this, assumedly, is lifelong. So this woman will be required to take immunosuppressive medicines for the rest of her life. For a transplant, which was not clearly required for her life. So this woman could have lived in this markedly disfigured fashion, admittedly a very difficult life, but it's not as if she needed a heart, and in the absence of the heart, she would have died. She could have lived a prolonged life without any issues had she not had the donation. We now move to our next form of donation, of non-vital organ donation, and that's the hand transplant. Some of you may have heard of this case. The first case was a couple years back. And I believe it is the same surgeon who performed the first face transplant who performed the first hand transplant. Quite a remarkable figure from France. So you may not realize it, but there have been a total of 24 hand transplants so far. And here I have a review from the Journal of Hand Surgery from February of 2006. 24 hands have been transplanted in 18 individuals. So some of the people who received transplants were bilateral amputees, had lost both of their limbs. And the purpose of this study was really just to assess some of the psychological issues. But here again, we have a transplant which is not required for preservation of life. We have many people who sadly lose limbs. Montefiore is also a referral center for all severed limbs. We are a limb replacement center. So in the general New York vicinity, people who, God forbid, lose limbs from fingers to hands or any extremity, they present to Montefiore for possible reattachment. And there are also, of course, ways to replace that hand with artificial limbs, which has progressed quite remarkably over the past few years. But again, they do not need this hand to live. A third form of transplant, which you may never have heard of, which is also a non-vital transplant, is a laryngeal transplant, transplant of the larynx. But what is the larynx? The larynx is the voice box. Now, you may have encountered people who are unable to speak or they use a voice box. So sometimes it's from trauma, if someone had trauma to the neck, or sometimes it's from cancer, if they had cancer which required removal of the larynx. And they will have sometimes these devices which assist them to speak, sometimes people can't speak. It's also a very debilitating thing, but again, not something which impacts the preservation of life. One can continue their life, long and healthy life with the absence of a larynx and the inability to speak. There is no terminal or chronic disease. And the final one of our discussion today is the uterine transplant, transplantation of the human uterus. And actually, just this week, there was a report from Science Daily that doctors believe that within the next 2 to 3 years, they will be able to transplant the uterus into a woman, and she will be able to bear a child with this new uterus. Quite remarkable remarkable surgery. And here we had an article from the European Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology. This is from 2003, talking about uterine transplant. And in fact, about 2-3 years ago, there was an attempted human uterus transplant, which occurred in Saudi Arabia, where a woman had her uterus removed for medical reasons and received a donated uterus from someone, a living donor, and they transplanted it into this woman. The organ was sustained in her body for 100 days, and because of complications with the circulation that was supplying the uterus had to be removed. The woman did not die as a result of the procedure, but she also didn't become pregnant as a result of the procedure, which is really the ultimate objective of a uterus transplantation. And what we will talk about in a few moments is the potential halachic ramifications, some of them quite fascinating, of these different kinds of non-vital organ transplants. But you have here also on your page, from the Center of Bioethics and Human Dignity from December of 2005, just a comment about these new types of transplantations. Since hand and larynx transplants began a few years ago, transplantation has again entered unprecedented territory. Those transplanting hands, larynx, and faces, and we would add to this list uteruses, must now address recipient risks for organs that are important but not essential to life. This is a completely different set of circumstances than encountered during the transplantation of kidneys, livers, and hearts. What I'd like to do for the remainder of our session is turn to a halachic analysis of these kinds of transplants. And in order to do that, we will just preface with a brief review of some of the remarks of Rabbi Willig, and then discuss the potential halachic concerns, not only of this group of non-vital organ transplants, but unique concerns of each type of transplant, of the uterus transplant, the hand transplant, the face transplant, etc. So on page 4 of your handout, you have the pasuk that was quoted by Rabbi Willig this afternoon, Lo sa'amod al dam reicha. And this issue really is the issue of risk, how much risk one can incur in order to save the life of another human being, or even to save their own life for that matter. So here in this field of live organ donation, these sources that you have, which I will summarize briefly, are sources that are the foundation of the notion of living organ, of the topic of living organ donation. So the Shulchan Aruch says, Haroa et chavera tovea bayam, and this is quoted by Rabbi Willig, if you see your neighbor who's drowning in the, your friend who's drowning in the ocean, ulistim boinolav, marauders or robbers attacking somebody, o chaya roa boinolav, or a wild animal attacking him, yachol hatzilo, and you can save him, either you yourself can save him, hu ba'atzmo, o shiyi skor acherim lahatzil, or you can hire somebody else to save him, v'lo yitzil, and you didn't do so, over al lo sa'amod al dam reicha. You have violated the prohibition of lo sa'amod al dam reicha. The question that is not addressed by the Shulchan Aruch is how much risk one can take in order to save that life. So we know that you're required to do it yourself, and you know that you're required to do it if you have to pay money, but how much risk do you have to incur in order to save the life of a human being? And this is really a major crux of the living organ donation issue. So Rav David ben Zimra was faced with the following dilemma, upon which he made a decision which serves as the foundation for the analysis of living organ donation. The question that was posed to him, tragic case, is two Jews are standing side by side, and a soldier or a despot or a king says to one Jew, allow me to amputate one of your limbs, and if you don't, I will kill the person standing next to you. So what is this person's obligation? On the one hand, you might say he's obligated because lo sa'amod al dam reicha. On the other hand, he's obligated to preserve his own self. V'nishmartem odo nafsho seichem. You have an obligation of self-preservation. So what are you supposed to do? So there are three possibilities here. Possibility one, he has to do it. He's obligated to do so by virtue of the law and the obligation to save somebody. The other polar extreme is he's forbidden to do such a thing because it would be a violation of his own self-preservation. And the third category is that he's permitted to do it but not obligated to do it. And that big chasm in the middle is the category that Rav David ben Zimra accepts for this particular case. And he says in the underlined section of the third source on his handout, it says the su dichsiv drachea darchinam. It says your words are the ways of God are the ways of pleasantness. And the way, there has to be some element, obviously this doesn't apply in everything, but there has to be some palatability or some logic involved that how is it possible that a law would require you, the Torah law would say you have to do this in order to save somebody's life, you have to lose your own limb. So he says, listen, you want to do it? It's a phenomenal thing, a laudatory thing, an exceptional act of chesed and kindness, and praised be he or she that does such a thing. But to obligate you to do such a thing, you're clearly not obligated to do so. These are sort of some parameters of risk which involve the organ donation, the living organ donation. Just to summarize some of what Willick said, and he also quoted from the Rabbi Yosef, which you have for your on your handout for your edification. So let us now turn to these issues of each particular organ and what each organ requires from a halachic analysis. Now we talked about living organ donation in a minute, but there's also cadaveric organ donation which figures into the equation, and here's how. Where do these organs come from for these non-vital organ transplants? We are concerned not only with the recipient, which we're going to talk about, the risk for the recipient, the halachic issues for the recipient, but also the issues related to the donors of these organs. So this woman got a face transplant. Where did this face come from? This face came from, as we read, a brain dead donor, someone who was brain dead. So what will probably not come out in our discussion this afternoon so much, because the focus will really be on brain death in specifics, but there are halachic issues that devolve upon the corpse. So one is obligated to bury the corpse, one is prohibited from desecrating the corpse, and prohibited from deriving benefit from the corpse. So on what basis can you transplant? How can you transplant? You have to bury it, you can't desecrate it, so how can you perform any transplant, even if the person is brain dead and you accept halachic brain death? So the answer is, because it's pikuach nefesh for the recipient. And it's life-saving for the recipient, which applies to everything you will hear both before and after this talk. So livers, lungs, kidneys, all life-saving for the recipient. So yes, of course, if you accept brain death as halachic death, and the organs come from brain-dead patients largely, then you are allowed to harvest these organs from these brain-dead patients, and you're allowed to violate the laws of obligation of burial and desecration of the body. They are superseded for this case of pikuach nefesh. So does this concept apply to our category of non-vital organ transplant? We have transplants that many of which come from the cadaveric donor. The face comes from the cadaveric donor. The hand comes from the cadaveric donor, because of course a living person isn't going to donate their hand. The larynx comes from a cadaveric donor, from a donor, deceased donor actually, more correctly, as Dr. Greenstein points out. The uterus we'll talk about in just a moment. But those three organs are all harvested, these non-vital organs, from a brain-dead donor. According to halacha, what do you think? Do you think halacha would allow a brain-dead person to donate those organs? How many people, by show of hands, how many people say halacha would not allow you to donate those organs? And how many people say they would? Dr. Greenstein, you want to come? You're just being the contrarian, Dr. Greenstein. So it's clear from the donor perspective for all these organs, one would probably not be allowed to do so because none of these patients fall into the real strict category of pikuach nefesh, and we have tremendous respect for the corpse, for the deceased, to the extent that we would only violate that tremendous sanctity for the preservation of life. Even in the case, yes, Dr. Greenstein.
Payments are important.
So excellent. Psychological pain is definitely considered a factor, but how that... does that rise to the level? There's no question that it's a factor, but does that rise to the level of classic pikuach nefesh? Not so clear, yes.
Okay, if that person was already a non-Jew, would that affect anything?
So the question is, if the donor was a non-Jew, would that make a difference? And the answer is, according to some poskim, yes. There is a question. The obligation of burial only devolves upon the Jewish body. There is a debate amongst the poskim whether the notion of of the Nivul Hames applies equally to Jewish and non-Jewish. So the answer is yes, it does. It does make a difference, and Poskim would argue about that point. Yes. Good. Excellent question. Excellent question. So corneal transplant is unique. It's unique on both ends of the coin. We need to analyze the recipient aspect of cornea and the donor aspect of cornea. So with respect to the donor, it's cadaveric donation, and it can also be from non-heart beating. It doesn't have to be brain-dead patient necessarily. Is the loss of vision to the recipient enough to justify the violation of these prohibitions of the body? And I think you alluded to, the Gemara says that summa doma lemes, that somebody who's blind... It's a homiletic statement that someone who's blind is equated with someone who is dead. Now, obviously, someone who's blind is not really dead. So, what does that mean? Is it just a homiletic statement without halachic consequence, or does it indeed mean that it has halachic ramifications that this person would be considered a state of pikuach nefesh? So, and also, let's say a person is blind in both eyes, and as opposed to somebody who's blind in one eye. Somebody who's blind in one eye can see, they can walk, they don't have to worry about lifnei iver l'sitei mifshol. I mean, this phrase of putting a stumbling block before the blind is not only a metaphorical phrase, it's a physical phrase. I mean, people who are blind are at risk of the potential harm. So most postmen would agree that they do fall into the category of pikuach nefesh, and you can allow people to donate the corneas. However, there even may be another permissibility to allow to donate, and that's on the flip side of the coin. We said the concern is desecration of the body. Is harvesting of a cornea considered desecration of the body? Is the volume of the cornea required for burial? So the answer to that is maybe no. So the difference is what is being harvested. So you might assume, which is actually not the case, that only the cornea is being harvested, that you just slice off this very small, micro-thin cornea, in which case there would clearly be no prohibition. There's no prohibition of desecration because you won't even notice the cornea is gone, and there's no obligation to bury a cornea. If you have to find a cornea lying on the floor, you don't have an obligation to bury a cornea. But they're harvesting the entire globe of the eye, not just the cornea. And then afterwards they will harvest the cornea. So the globe of the eye also may not necessarily fit the volume of requisite burial. So you need a kazayis for burial. The volume of the globe is roughly 30 cc's, 30 milliliters, and may not be the equivalent of the volume of kazayis. And additionally, there's a very interesting psak by Rav Unterman, one of the former chief rabbis of Eretz Yisrael, about eye transplants, and in particular, his read or take on the concept of nivul is something which was visible to the eye, no pun intended for our discussion. And so he says that at burial, the eye is closed. So you harvest the eye, or you harvest the cornea. You don't even know that the cornea has been harvested. There's no aspect of nivul hames for him. So all these things in conjunction make cornea transplants also permitted. Any questions on this before? Do you have a question yet? Correct. So here's another, I'm glad you mentioned that. There's another fascinating, and I'm not sure if this is Rav Unterman, I think it might be Rav Unterman also, who has a beautiful idea which applies not only to cornea, but applies to other things as well, that once the cornea or heart or liver or lung is transplanted, it is no longer a dead body. It becomes reanimated in the recipient. So the answer is nivul hames. But once it's transplanted and integrates into the recipient, it's no longer mace anymore. And the question applies to a kohen, right? A kohen's not allowed to... Right, it's a creative... you could argue the point. Admittedly, you could argue the point. It was mace at one stage. You're still being nana from the mace. So it's a creative approach. There's no question about it. But it's invoked also with respect to kohanim. A kohen is not allowed to be exposed to a corpse. So for pikuach nefesh, of course, you're allowed to do it. But in addition to the pikuach nefesh element, you could argue that he's not exposing himself to the dead body. It becomes reanimated in him, and now it's functional tissue. It's not a dead body anymore. It's reanimated functional tissue. Yes?
A bit more about the percentage of cases where the organ is rejected and it doesn't work out. And then does the body then revert back to being dead after having been reanimated?
No backseats, right? That was Dr. Greenstein's... That's an excellent question. It is. It doesn't become once, and this takes on halachic ramifications. The organ doesn't die. Right. So, for example, now Stu said no backseat. No backseat applies to the chiyuv of kavura also. Let me ask you this question: You're performing an organ transplant. You harvested an organ from somebody who died. According to the psak, that brain death is halachic death. You take someone's heart and you transplant it into Joe Stein. Now, Joe Stein got, you know, lives a long, healthy life with this transplant, and he dies at 120. Do you have to take out that heart and now bury it with the donor? After all, the donor should be buried whole. Now, he allowed himself not to be buried whole because of pikuach nefesh. But maybe you should, you know, implant a LoJack or a GPS system in every organ that's transplanted, so, you know, once people die, you can find all those organs and bring them back and reinter them with their proper owners. So the answer is no, you absolutely categorically do not have to do that from a halachic perspective.
I assume you're going to get this, but obviously in these cases, the flip side of Rashaf's discussion is true. Here, there would be a tremendous kula, or people to ignore all these issues if we decide that brain death is in fact not that, because then you're harvesting all of these non-vital organs from a live donor.
Excellent question. Excellent point. However, big however, even if that person would be considered alive, and some people have argued, even if you don't accept brain death, take a kidney from them. What's the big deal, right? But the answer is, you are causing harm and potentially hastening the death of this living brain dead person, according to those who accept brain death. So you can't remove, this operation is in no way, clearly no way beneficial to the donor. Even if you consider him halakhically alive. So granted, he would be a living donor, according to Rav Schefter, but you can't remove a face from somebody who's alive. You can't remove a hand from somebody who's alive. That's Chavala. You would never give permission to do something like that. Now,
given that, given Rav Schefter's answer to Dr. Prager that we can't prevent it, your question is addressing the issue of would we permit it, given that it's already happening.
Oh, see, the difference in those cases, and Dr. Prager highlighted a very important issue, and Rav Schefter also addressed it. I'm sure he would have addressed it more thoroughly if he had more time, but there isn't necessarily hypocrisy to not donate yet receive. It's not so clear on real analytical approach that there's hypocrisy, because it requires microanalysis. But if the organ, the surgeon says, listen, this person is declared brain dead, the family's decided to donate, I'm removing the organs. Once those organs are sitting on the table, there is no prohibition for anybody to benefit from that.
And at that point, once the organs have been removed, and you're determining whether to finish.
Right, but in this case, these organs are routinely removed in harvesting. Faces are not routinely removed, hands are not routinely removed. So those would only be done in a very specific targeted case. So that analysis wouldn't necessarily apply. Rochelle, did you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Yes.
Wasn't your original question about the face? And I wanted to ask, it says over here that she wasn't able to eat.
Ah, okay.
Was eating part of vital?
Good question. Right. She doesn't necessarily have to eat orally. There are many people who unfortunately are not able to eat by mouth. So they have a feeding tube, and they can get complete nutrition through the feeding tube. And we're not talking about debilitated people that don't talk or don't move. We're talking healthy people who simply, for anatomical reasons, can't have the food pass from their mouth to their stomach. They put a tube into the stomach, and the food goes directly into the stomach. They can lead the normal life. Yes, Dr. Greenstein.
I want to ask you something about from Brother Shaker. Now, what you're saying is you won't get enough to be dead. But how do we handle the whole issue of bringing the world into
The question was that if organ's not being perfused, then it's a dead organ. There you would simply invoke the pikuach nefesh element, that a kohen's allowed to violate the issue of tuma in order to save his life. So you wouldn't necessarily, this notion of the reanimation of the organ is sort of an additional thing, but you don't really need it because it's pikuach nefesh. If a kohen needs a heart transplant, it's clearly pikuach nefesh. Did you? Right, so that's a good question also. The reperfusion, the organs are all being reperfused from the moment that they're harvested. And actually, that's one of the technologies that they're working on very vigorously to expand the viability of the organ. And we said at the beginning of the conference, you know, the length of our conference is roughly the viability of the time of viability of a heart once it's been removed for transplantation. One of the areas, and Dr. Greenstein I'm sure knows more about this than I do, one of the areas that they're actively working on is try and expand that from 6 hours to 12 hours or days. Kidneys can last, 36, 48 hours once they've been harvested, but hearts and livers...
Okay.
Ah, no, but once the organ comes from someone who is diagnosed halachically as being dead, then it, then the tumah begins immediately. So whether the reanimation negates the tumah, reverses the tumah, you know, then we can argue these points. Yeah. Yes, we are going to address that, and after your question, we will address that forthwith. The so we talked about donation. So we said most of these organs, and we'll talk about uterus in a minute, which is fascinating halachic issues, are the donor aspect. But what about the recipient aspect? And the real issue, which you really pinpointed, is how much risk can somebody take in order to perform a procedure which is simply enhancing as opposed to life-saving? And this is obviously a continuum and obviously a spectrum. I mean, we've all seen these television shows, you know, extreme makeovers and all these kinds of things where people are undergoing major radical cosmetic surgery. We're not talking nose jobs anymore. We're talking like people looking completely different by the time they finish with all these operations, many of which require major surgical interventions, many of which are, you know, they show you all the success stories on television. They're not showing you all the failures. They're not showing people who have infections as a result. They're not showing people who sustain complications from anesthesia, which albeit is very small. So that's the crux of the halachic issue. Can one expose themselves to this kind of danger? What would allow them to expose themselves to these kinds of risks? Now, these regular cosmetic procedures are a one-time risk. You undergo the procedure, there's the risk of the procedure. Some are more extensive risks than others. But this case, for every single transplant, this isn't a one-time surgical risk. This is a lifelong risk on immunosuppressive medicines. Every single day of their lives, if they catch a cold, they can die from catching a cold. So would halacha allow these people to take this kind of risk? And what would justify exposing themselves to this risk? So the simple answer is that probably not. Halacha would probably not allow this kind of really extensive, prolonged risk, unless there's some mitigating reason, halachic reason, which would allow that justification. So what is a potentially mitigating halachic reason? Now here I mentioned for thought, for discussion, this is by no means a halachic psak, but each one of these has its own attendant issues which might possibly allow us to at least think about permitting. So we said this woman can't eat, or this woman can't speak. So there are a number of mitzvahs in the Torah which require eating and speaking. So Pesach, for example, there's a chiyuv of achilas matzah. There's an obligation to eat matzah. There's an obligation to eat maror. There are many mitzvahs in the Torah which require both speech and eating. Would the fact that this woman would simply not be able to observe or perform these mitzvahs be sufficient to allow us to expose her to a risk in order to do such a thing? And I have, I mean, we won't read it through, but just for your interest, I have a number of sources with respect to the to people who have amputated limbs. The person would not be able, if there was a man, he wouldn't be able to put on tefillin. So you can say, is it justified to expose yourself to the risk in order to facilitate the performance of mitzvahs? I think it would enter into the equation. I don't think it would be sufficient to meet the threshold to override this prolonged lifelong risk. But you have here a number of tshuvos, which coincidentally Rav Schechter mentioned in his analysis of brain death, about which hand tefillin should go on if a person has a stroke, if a person loses the sensation of a limb, loses function of a limb. You're supposed to put on tefillin on your weak hand. Let's say your strong hand now becomes your weak hand because you had a stroke that caused you to have weakness on your dominant hand. So do you switch tefillin? So there'd be interesting questions about somebody who is a recipient of a hand transplant, if and when they would be able to put tefillin on that hand. Would you have to wait till sensation returns to the hand, till, let's say, that hand will grow to become a dominant hand with the transplant, so then it's possible you'll be switching hands for tefillin during the course of time. Yeah.
That is just a somewhere about
There clearly are extensive discussions about how much risk you have to put yourself or how much financial strain you have to put on yourself in order to perform mitzvah or to prevent yourself from performing a mitzvah losatze. So the financial formula, for example, to perform a mitzvah sase, you have to expend 20% of your wealth to perform a mitzvah slot. To prevent yourself from violating a lav, you have to spend your whole fortune. You know, and that actually comes up for sukkahs by the etzrogim. But that, there's no question that that can be assimilated to here. That discussion can be assimilated here. How much risk you have to do to perform a mitzvah, and that is it's absolutely a factor in this discussion.
Someone who's missing a limb, if we have no obligation for not doing anything, is it that you have an obligation and you can't perform it, or
all right, it's like a cheres shots of a katan, or so they no longer have that obligation. So, right, so it's not like they have an obligation to reverse that status. It's just their obligation. Right, that's an excellent point as well. They don't have an obligation necessarily to reverse that status, but if we have the opportunity to reverse that status and to facilitate the performance of mitzvahs, which we're always is a laudatory thing, would that factor into a decision to allow them to expose themselves to some type of risk? Now, we're having this discussion in 2006 when immunosuppressive drugs are generally pretty dangerous. But one of the things they're also experimenting with is changing the recipe of immunosuppressive drugs to make them not so dangerous. And there's study, I just read a study this morning, actually, about medications that are not as toxic, medications that may not have to be lifelong, even. So these things might all change the equations. Every analysis of a medical halacha discussion has to accept the existing medical information. The medical facts might change, the denominator might change, the results might change radically. Also, with respect to Birchas Kohanim, we said that putting on tefillin is some issue. There are actually discussions about whether a Kohen amputee is permitted to perform the priestly blessing. And according to some poskim, a Kohen amputee would not be able to perform the priestly blessing, even though he's under the talus anyway. He wouldn't be able to see necessarily that there's an amputation is taking place. But since it's the yadayim that are required for the performance of the blessing and the absence of the hands, they may not indeed be able to convey the priestly blessing. There could be some interesting issues about the larynx transplant. Let's say a man has a woman's larynx transplanted. Would that be kol isha now if he sings? But the same thing with respect to things which require speech. You know, all mitzvahs that require the utterance, tefillah, zechiras yitzias mitzrayim, remember a whole host of issues that require speech. Brachos are just drabanan. Would that factor into allowing a larynx transplant, which is a very complex surgery? In fact, they even had one successful larynx transplant. Is quite extraordinary. But just to address another transplant that we haven't talked about, and that's the uterus transplant, and we'll close with this. We have, I think, till 4:15, and then we have a break from 4:15 to 4:30 for our last session. But I'd be happy to stay for any questions that you have. The uterus transplant actually presents some very interesting halachic issues. First of all, we address the issue of donation of the uterus, and we've said that generally, there would be a prohibition for all these others, which are donated from cadaver donors. The uterus can actually be donated from either cadaver or a live donor. And even the cadaver donation, we talked about the cornea as not being nivul hameis. The uterus doesn't necessarily have to be harvested from an incision in the abdomen, which would be a disfiguring incision. The uterus could be harvested through what's called a vaginal hysterectomy, which shows no external incision whatsoever. In which case there may be no technical nivul hameis, and this would be a machlokas, it's not so simple, but you may be able to harvest the uterus from someone without having a technical, overt, macroscopic nivul hameis. But the uterus is the only one of these non-vital organs which can be donated from a living donor. Now, who would be donating a uterus? So there's another aspect of medical halacha specifically relating to Jews, which reveals a population who could potentially be donating their uterus. And who is this population? You're all familiar, I'm sure, with the cancer genes that are associated with certain cancers in the Jewish population. And one of these genes, or two of these genes, the BRCA1 gene and the BRCA2 gene, are associated with cancers of the breast and cancers of the ovaries. So envision this scenario, which is not uncommon and is occurring today. A woman who finds out that she is positive for BRCA 1 and 2 has a potentially high risk of ovarian cancer, and she decides she wants to have her ovaries taken out. Now, the halacha here, this also is one of those issues where we are now in this period of evolution, both in the medical world and in the halachic world, about how much this will prevent cancer. Will it prevent cancer entirely? Will it just decrease the risk? How much will it decrease the risk? Those statistics are literally changing on a week-by-week and a month-by-month basis. Is it halachically permitted for a woman to undergo a removal of her ovaries? Let's say she's 25 years old and she finds out that she's positive in BRCA1 and 2. The statistics are that she may develop ovarian cancer, may. These are not, you have to appreciate, this does not mean that the person will develop it 100%. It means that there's a percentage they will develop it. They'll probably develop it a little later in life. At what stage should they remove the ovaries, if at all? Should they accept this risk on themselves when they're completely healthy to have a surgery, which is a risky surgery, to prevent them from having a disease they may never get? And also, childbearing is a factor. There's an obligation of kuruvua, at least on the couple, perhaps more halachically on the man than on the woman. But should she wait till she's had children before she removes her ovaries? And if so, how many children? Should you wait for 2 children, 4 children, 5 children? These are not simple questions. But assuming that she decides with halachic approval to perform the removal of both of her ovaries, she says, listen, you're already removing the ovaries, and one of the halachic issues, by the way, in removing the ovaries is a prohibition of sterilization, of sirus. You're not allowed to remove reproductive organs in the human being. So there's a debate about the difference between the reproductive organs in the man versus the woman and the nature of the prohibitions. But let's say she gets a permission to remove the ovaries for medical reasons, and she says, you're already removing the ovaries, why don't you take the uterus? I'm not going to need it anymore. And donate the uterus for uterine donation. Is that something which would be halachically permitted? There is a prohibition of sterilization of serous for both the uterus and the ovaries. So would the halacha be, since you're already removing the ovaries, you're already performing the prohibition of sterilization, there's no additional prohibition of removing the uterus? Or would you say that yesh serous achar serous, if you've already removed the ovaries, then there's an additional prohibition of removing the uterus as well? Yes. So that's an excellent question. Why would you even donate a uterus? Why would somebody want a uterus transplant? You can get egg donation. You can take your egg. Let's say you don't have a uterus, and there are thousands of people that suffer from congenital absence of uterus. They're born without a uterus. And there's people who are healthy people who have functioning ovaries who have their uterus removed for medical reasons, be it for fibroids or excess vaginal bleeding, a whole host of different things. So would these people benefit? Why do they need a uterine transplant? They can just take their ovaries and their eggs, harvest the husband's sperm, fertilize it in the laboratory, and hire a surrogate and have a surrogate mother. So there are halachic issues, and that itself is a whole day conference, and maybe that'll be our next conference, the issues of assisted reproduction. And actually, we'll talk about a fascinating case of uterine transplant, a challenging halachic dilemma in a minute. Yes.
Technically, there's a much greater sakana for the donor to donate her uterus in addition to just having her ovaries. Morbidity rate for hysterectomy, in addition to taking the ovaries, with just taking the ovaries alone, is much greater.
So it's bilateral oophorectomy versus oophorectomy and hysterectomy.
Right.
The latter is a higher risk. Okay, so that's an important halachic factor. So the argument might be, listen, you're already opening the abdomen anyway, so may as well just take the uterus. Maybe there's not much surgical risk. But if indeed doctors tell you there's a higher surgical morbidity or mortality associated with that double operation, that indeed might militate against being a donor in that particular case. That's a very important fact in the halachic decision making. Yes. Right, that's an excellent point, and that factors into the halachic decision. That was a case after Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zatzal, about whether someone is having a hysterectomy. I think the case that was presented to him was a woman having a hysterectomy, and there was a risk in the family. There was a family history of ovarian cancer. So because of that added medical risk, can they perform the additional removal of the ovaries at the same time? So that would be a medical decision. But here we're talking about a case where there's no risk of a uterine cancer. It's a separate, the BRCA1 and 2 does not predispose to uterine cancer.
No, it's not. People do it for different things.
All right, so okay. But, So Moshe answered, yes, it would be permitted to do. It would be permitted to do. But I just want, I know it's running a little late, I just want to share with you this fascinating halachic case about the uterine transplant. Let's say you have a woman who never had a child, and she has some medical removal of her uterus. She has vaginal bleeding, which required hysterectomy, and she's 25 years old. She receives a uterine transplant from a woman who has had two or three children. When she receives this transplant, she now gives birth to a child. Does this child require a pidyon haben or not? Is this child the firstborn or not? Now, what defines the firstborn? So to the rechem itself, isolated, this is not the peter rechem, this is not the firstborn of this womb. This woman has given birth to other children. To this woman, this is a peter rechem. This is her first child with this womb that she has now received. So what do you think the halachic answer to that one's going to be?
Who does the rechem really belong to?
So the question also, what is the status of the rechem? Does the rechem retain its status of the donor?
So
I'll share with you this, and this will close. And I apologize, I'll close, and I'll be happy to stay as long as you want for any other questions. There was a case in, and this is a particular fascination of mine, there was a case back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, which generated a flurry of halachic literature, which has since been perpetuated. But to go back to that original literature is just mind-boggling. There was a discussion in this case, in page 6 of your handout. There was a question posed in a halacha journal in Hungary, the premier halacha journal in Hungary. Reading from the third line, it says, "Atzia b'zeh she'ela shenistapakti l'halacha. I want to present for a forum discussion in this journal a fascinating halachic inquiry. The harofim himtziu potach bulo laoshid klei leida me'isha be'isha akara. The doctors in this is 1907. This was written. The doctors in our time have devised a new procedure to treat for infertility. What's the procedure? The procedure was they transplanted reproductive organs from one woman to another woman. And he talks about the halachic ramifications of transplant." Of entire reproductive organ system. So this question assumed that there was a case that was the transplantation of ovaries, uterus, and external reproductive system, the entire wholesale thing, into a living woman. And it generated an entire discussion in the halachic literature of all the halachic ramifications of such a procedure. It turned out that wasn't actually the medical case. The medical case, the original medical case, is on your handout in the bottom left, which is from 1906, which was a man who performed just an ovarian transplant. A sliver of an ovary was transplanted from one woman to the other. But because the person who asked the question in the halachic journal was not aware of all the medical realities and asked the question assuming everything was transplanted, they included in their discussions uterus transplant. So we have a whole halachic literature in the early 1900s discussing halachic ramifications of uterus transplant. And one of the cases, and one of the questions they asked is, would it be a pidyon haben or not? Would it be a bechor or would it not be a bechor? Would a pidyon haben be required or not be required? And one of the sources they marshal, which is fascinating, again, just to show the breadth of knowledge these Gedolei Torah had, is they marshal a Gemara in Bechoros, which discusses a hypothetical case. And it's talking about Bechor Behema, I think, and I'm not sure it's talking about a human being, it's talking about animals. If an animal has a birth, and the child of the animal exits the birth canal without touching any walls of the birth canal at all, so in theory the birth canal would be very wide, and the animal floats through the birth canal outside, levitates through the birth canal, never touches the walls of the uterus, never touches the walls of the birth canal, would that resultant child be considered a bechor, and would pidyon haben be required or not? So they say, well, I don't know. I mean, is the physical touching of the birth canal walls required to generate the status of a bechor or not? So the Gemara leaves it as a suffix. So the poskim in this generation said, maybe that applies to this case of the woman who's a recipient. Granted, the walls may not be her walls of the rechem, but the avir harechem, the air of the rechem, is clearly hers, clearly belongs to her. So at the very minimum, it should be a suffix before. It should be a status of a questionable before. And this is just the tip of the iceberg of this entire halachic literature.
So suffix before
would get a pidyon haben without a bracha.
Without a bracha.
And also there's a fascinating tshuva by Rav Levi Yitzchak Halpern that talks about Pidyon HaBen in a regular case of the surrogate motherhood. So let's say a woman who's a surrogate, she gets you have the egg and the sperm from the husband, they fertilize it in the laboratory, and they transplant it into a woman who's now the surrogate mother. So he said, would the resultant child require Pidyon HaBen or not? What's the question? The question is, the prerequisite of Pidyon HaBen is that the person who gives birth to the child is the halachic mother of the child. You have to have both the person giving birth and the person defined as the halachic mother. If the person giving birth to the child is not defined as a halachic mother, the child may indeed not require a Pidyon HaBen. Fascinating issue. We just want to close and I'll be happy to answer other questions. So in conclusion, we've at least begun to address a new frontier in transplantation, the transplantation of non-vital organs, which generates a whole host of new and exciting halachic issues, the application of Torah to the development of science, including face transplants and hand transplants, larynx transplants, and uterus transplants. We'll now return in the next few minutes to our discussions of the definition of death for what promises to be a very exciting remainder of the afternoon. Yes? So the question is, what's the halachic status to the surrogate mother? So in this particular case, and again, this could be an entire full-day conference, at least. There is a major halachic debate about this, who is considered the halachic mother in the case of surrogacy. All positions are espoused, every position. So there's a position that the genetic mother is considered the halachic mother. There's a position that the host mother, or the gestational, or the birth mother is considered the halachic mother. There's a position that Tzitz Eliezer that neither is considered the halachic mother, and there's a position that both are considered the halachic mother. Now, why is that relevant? Because you have to know to whom to send a card on Mother's Day. So Hallmark Paskins that both are the mothers. But you also have to know if you have two mothers-in-law. Obviously it's very important issues for Arias. You have to know who's your sister. You have to know who you can marry and who you can't marry. Right. Probably not. Probably not. There's no genetic material there.
The category is that the organism is trying to grow a new life and therefore a new limb. In the process of the transplant itself, once one is removed from the body, that therefore considered a dead limb, and therefore once implanted deemed from a live donor or a cadaveric donor, it should therefore be considered a new limb entirely. So therefore, the new leg should not be considered.
Right.
Once
it becomes integrated into the woman, it becomes a new bone.
And this last point, wasn't that Moshe very clear about that the first mother
This was not a big issue in the times of Moshe. To my knowledge, you should ask her by Tendler. To my knowledge, Moshe did not talk to
him. More like Tendler.
Because maybe it wasn't written, to my knowledge.
It was in his. I heard it from him, but that's not his day to pass. That's his grandmother passed. But the birth mother
is the
halakhic mother.
We don't operate by majority necessarily, but a lot of rabbanim passed in that indeed it's the.